I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Randy Anderson. He's the superintendent of the Snake River Hotshot Crew with the Bureau of Land Management. We're talking about wildfires today, Peter. And, you know, we've done a few episodes broaching the topic of fires, and, you know, it really is the fifth season in Idaho. You know, we can count on having a dry period where things start burning, and thankfully we have a lot of professionals who are trained to manage them, to put them out. And so Randy is one of those. He's led a career in that field, and we're going to learn a whole lot more about wildfires in Idaho and the region.
These guys are some, and gals are some amazing people.
It's not an easy task to do the job that they do, but the ones that I've met are really dedicated to doing the work and take it very seriously. And it's obviously really, really important to everybody that lives around here. So we'll get into that. But, you know, first up, let's talk a bit of nature news.
Nature news. This isn't about fire, but we're going to talk about tropical storms and hurricanes. And how they're actually named.
Well, so we're recording this, fun little fact, we're recording this in 2020, and this is an epic year for hurricanes.
And tropical storms. Naming these storms really didn't start until the end of the 40s and early 50s. Beforehand, they were just assigning these storms numbers. This is the year, and if it's 1947, this is the third storm of the year, so it was named 19-19473. That was leading to a lot of confusion. You know, you're trying to broadcast out information about these storms. Folks were getting confused.
Just they because might, it was a number.
It was a number. Yeah. They might say 19-473 in their area, but that storm was actually 300, 400, 500 miles away. So people were getting confused, and they decided to move towards, and this is initially, it was a female name because names were quicker and easier to recognize, and it reduces confusion. And okay, they started this in 1953. And by 1978, they decided that they were going to start using both male and female names. And so this is the naming that we have right now. It's the World Meteorological Organization. And they have a very strict policy in how they name storms, and it's actually on a six-year rotation. So they've got these names set up for 6 years, and then they'll rotate them and flip back to the start again. If you look back in the history of these storms, there's some pretty massive storms that they've decided to retire, in a sense, so we don't lose the fact that, for instance, Hurricane Katrina was so large and it had such a large effect within the United States. They'll retire these names. Since 1953, they've retired 89 names. The largest decade was in the 2000s where they retired 24 storm names. And I think right now in the 2010s, they had 15 names that were retired. Just remember, we're starting a brand new decade.
Right now it's November 2020. And of course, we name hurricanes and tropical storms, that sort of thing, alphabetically. So they start with names A, B, C, so forth. We're up to Iota. Iota just landed in Nicaragua.
Greek alphabet.
Yes. Will we run out of Greek letters? One might wonder. I think the way in which we name these things tells you a lot about how our relationship to natural processes on Earth changes over time because they're changing, or how we respond to them needs to change, which is kind of a fascinating thing on its own. You know, today we're talking about wildfires. And like I said before, it's sort of like the fifth season here in Idaho. We just know that the fires are going to come, and it's a matter of when, you know, and what the severity and where they're going to be located in any given year. We'll get into that. But, you know, our trivia question for today deals with a really important Idaho figure. The question is, what is a Pulaski and what's its connection to Idaho? We're going to talk about wildfires and give you that answer later on in the show. So when we come back from the break, and get to learn more about wildfires and what the Hotshot crew has to do fighting those fires.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Randy Anderson. He's the superintendent of the Snake River Hotshot crew from the Bureau of Land Management, and he has over 30 years' experience fighting fires. Thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm excited to be here.
Well, so you have, I would say, one of the most interesting jobs I've ever heard of. Could you tell us what a Hotshot crew member does?
We're a 20-person crew. There's probably close to 100 in the nation. Most of them are federal. There's a few state and a couple of municipal, but primarily we all work for the federal land agencies, mostly the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And we are funded for national use, kind of unlike, say, for example, the Bureau of Land Management engine crews, that their primary duty is to fight fires locally. For us, we're funded to be used anywhere in the nation, and that's primarily in the western states, although we do go around a bit. Last year, we went to Canada, for example, which was pretty exciting. That doesn't happen that much. This winter, we sent a couple people to Australia for a month. Those are kind of rare occasions, but primarily we work in the western U.S. We're full-time fire for the period that we're available, which is between 4 to 5 months. We have some other duties, doing local project work and fuels mitigation, you know, cutting trees around houses and different areas for resource purposes. But primarily we're wildland firefighters. And typically hotshot crews will go to bigger fires where the fires are a little more difficult to get into in the more rugged terrain.
Approximately about 2,000 hotshots. How many acres, in a sense, do you guys have to manage and or fight depending on the season?
They do kind of come up with totals for acres burned. Wow. Size isn't always a great indicator of intensity or what kind of fire season, because you could have, you know, with rangeland or grass fires that get really big fast, you know, 140,000 acres in an afternoon, or you could be in the timber where 10,000 acres could be a very difficult fire. So size is kind of a tougher reference depending on what kind of vegetation it's in. Yeah, so say a typical year would be somewhere around 10 million acres. And then the numbers can be all over the place. 50,000 isn't, you know, out of the norm for amounts of fire.
And so you were saying size doesn't really matter. It's the intensity that
intensity, but vegetation types. So say you could have a sagebrush fire, like the season before last, 2018, we had some crazy growth on sagebrush fires. They would get up over 100,000 acres pretty rapidly. You could go up on the Boise National Forest or the Sawtooth National Forest, where you could have a 25,000 acre fire that's really going to take you some time to get around. So the difference is the vegetation type, whereas the sagebrush, and it's unfortunate when it burns, but it's very fast. It'll burn through there in a day. And 2 days later, if you work the edges, it's you work around it, it's cold, it's not going anywhere, you move on. You put that same size footprint on a timber fire, and you're going to be there for a long time making sure that the threat is taken out of it.
Can you tell me some of the requirements for people to be members of a hotshot crew?
For hotshot crews, we have a standards we have to follow. One of them is the amount of experience, and it isn't a terrible amount. It's like 80% have to have prior fire experience. So we could technically hire 2 to 4 people without any fire experience. That said, it's pretty unusual that we don't hire someone without that experience. You know, we have some very experienced supervisors. The experience is plenty to get the crew through a summer safely. But one of the things I like people to have experience for is that they know what they're getting into. It's a tough job to be away from home and be away from everything for, you know, basically 5 months, that your whole life is on hold. You're out 14 to 16 days at a time. You come home, you have 2 days off, and then you're back at it. Young people are attracted to the job, and that's great, but they'll get started and they'll get through, you know, it's pretty fun and exciting your first season. And then come August, you know, you really find out what it's about. And that can be really difficult for people to get through those last 8 or 12 weeks of a very long summer where you find out it's really not maybe as much fun as you thought it would be. And you kind of find out what, you know, what you're made of and if you really like the job or not at that point.
It must be really physically demanding.
It is. It you know, we try to hire people that are physically fit. And a lot of people think that we're out, you know, swinging tools and hiking up mountains all summer and that we're really fit at the end of the year. And it's actually kind of wears you down and breaks you down. So we kind of stress for people to show up at the beginning of the year, you know, in their peak form, knowing that come October, they're going to be beat up and tired. And so you kind of lose a lot of fitness over the summer, but it is a very physical job. We wear 40 plus pound packs and we're on our feet most of the time. We do get a little allotted time to work out every day that we're not on a fire. And so if you have, you know, try to find people that enjoy that versus the kind of people that look at that as like a burden to their day. If you can start out with people that like to A, work hard, and two, be fit, and then, you know, are self-motivated, they're going to do well at this job.
It's not a 40-hour-a-week job, is it?
It is not. It is not. It's a crazy amount of hours over a summer.
Talk a little bit. You mentioned that your pack is 40 pounds. Can you kind of go through the typical gear that you guys are moving into these sites with?
Absolutely. So we will go in. Ideally, we have enough drinking water. That's a big part of the battle. Ideally, you'd have enough water for a day or a work shift, but that's not physically impossible in the heat of the summer. But water weight is a big part of that. So you're talking 6 to 7 quarts of water. And then there'll be like a quart each of chainsaw gas and a quart of bar oil for the chainsaws, because we're typically packing and running 4 chainsaws, and they get pretty thirsty too. So everyone's required to carry some fuel. And then in addition to that, we'll have little, call them Dolmars, 2.5 gallon of sawgas and bar oil as well. Then you have food. So we'll try to have like say 3 meals or so of food. And a lot of that is just snacks and, you know, high energy, high carbs that you can grab quick and eat. And then you have a fire shelter, which is a mandatory piece of equipment. And they're about 8 pounds. Headlamp, lots of first aid, being ready for any kind of weather conditions, and if you should have to spend the night with your pack. So I like to have people have a dry layer that they can get into, because you get pretty sweaty. And then most of the time we're working up in higher elevations, or just the nighttime air gets pretty cool. So at the end of a shift, you can, you know, get into something dry. A beanie, you know, little things like a toothbrush is huge when you're out there, because we don't get the opportunity to shower all that much. So sometimes brushing your teeth feels like a shower. And then, yeah, the 4 chainsaws, hand tools, you have, you know, and then your clothes, fire resistant clothes, all that kind of stuff adds up pretty easily as far as what you got to move around with.
Right. And then often you're in mountainous terrain.
Yeah, the fires that we go to aren't unfortunately in flat ground that much.
I don't know if such a thing as a typical day actually exists, but, you know, what would be one type of day that a crew would face? How long is a shift? You know, what's the experience like?
So good question. So I'll start with a typical day. You know, usually when we start up in May, we'll do a good 2 to 2.5 weeks of a lot of classroom and you know, some physical training, getting ready for the fire season. After that, not all the fire seasons just start like this one ended. It'll start a little bit slow, so we'll go out on fires maybe, but we might be at home a little bit at that point in the year. So come in, we do physical training, which is any activities from going for a jog, hiking, CrossFit, lifting weights, lots of stretching, that sort of thing. And then fire classes, like prescribed fire, we do lots of leadership training, that sort of thing. Then the other alternative on those days would be to go out and do some of the local projects. A lot of it's fuels mitigation, either preparing for a prescribed fire or just also doing work for sage grouse, that sort of thing. And I can look out my office window in just about any directions, and I've seen work that we've done over the years around Pocatello. Some of that involved where we came in later or burned or made piles and burned in the winter, or just cut fuels just to let the native grasses grow and that sort of thing. The other alternative is we're on fires, which is most of the time. Once you get a few weeks into the season, from that point on, we're out for 14 days, work days plus travel, come back home for a couple days off, and then repeat that till October sometime. A typical day on a fire is we'll often get up at 6 or start the shift at 6. One of the safety premises is a briefing, which is given to us by an incident management team or whoever's in charge of that particular fire. In that, you'd get, you know, a good weather briefing, which is very key to us, and knowing what the weather is going to do all the time, so we can anticipate what the fire is going to do based on weather. And then you'll get a big picture of what everybody else is doing on a fire, what the priorities are. So you get your briefing. Meal times are pretty short typically. This summer was a lot different because there weren't really large fire camps like we usually have, which is kind of like COVID. So there's a lot more crews camping up in the hills. Guys are burning 5,000-6,000 calories a day. So food's a big part of our what we do is eat. Usually it's a minimal time to eat and then pack up your gear for a lot of crews. We'll pack up their stuff. We don't leave a camp somewhere with tent set up. You know, all our stuff's pretty back on the trucks, pretty mobile. And then we'll get into whatever the task is. And typically we'll work till the daylight's gone and maybe even later. So lots of shifts go from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. That changes with the length of season, and you get into September and it's dark at 8 o'clock. You know, it's kind of nice that time of year because you're typically don't work into the night hours, but that happens quite a bit too. And especially in like range fires, for example, that's in the heat of summer. That's when you get the work done is nighttime.
It sounds like a very long day, and you do those 14 straight, right? With an 8 hour break, maybe, to get some much needed rest, and then you're back out.
Correct. Yeah. I try to shoot for 8 hours, have these guys in their sleeping bags laying down for that long, but it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes that involves like getting food and driving back to your camping spot or something like that. But it's all about rest. When I supervise, I really try to highlight that and get it when you can. That's a big part of staying healthy, because then as the fire season progress, they get the bugs and crud that goes around. And once one person catches something, it passes through the crew. And so we really work hard at trying to avoid that in the first place and keep people as healthy as we can.
So Randy, you've been doing this just for a few years, correct? Through your time, how has not only firefighting technology changed, but how has the fires changed themselves?
Yes, to all. The technology's changed. One primary thing, they've always used a lot of aviation. I think now they use more aviation than ever before. And that's a good thing. It's expensive. When you see the cost of wildfires, a big part of that is aviation resources, but it really can make a huge difference in stopping fires. The airport here in Pocatello, they can accommodate the large air tankers. And those definitely have a place in stopping larger fires. The power of like the helicopters has changed, and the amount of waters they can drop is pretty impressive. But ironically, some of the changes at my level is, you know, hiking up in the hills. I've had a heavy pack since I started, and the chainsaws have gotten way more powerful, but they haven't necessarily gotten a lot lighter. And the water still weighs the same, and gas and oil still weighs the same. And everybody's still eating 5,000 to 6,000 calories a day. And so in, you know, in some ways, some of those changes haven't trickled down yet as much as we would have liked. And then the second part of your question is, yeah, I think fire seasons are getting, they're getting longer. We're seeing more bigger fires. My first season on a hotshot crew was down in Arizona. We had a local fire there, the Dude Fire. And it was, I think, 28,000 acres in timber. And there was a lot of people like, wow, this is a big fire. This is serious stuff. Things are changing. That's what they were saying then. And now we don't even raise an eyebrow at 28,000 in timber or in the grass or brush, something like that. So the sizes are definitely changing. I think 2 years ago I was on a fire and, you know, we were having 40-mile runs. This is unfortunately taking out a lot of nice sagebrush over in northern Nevada, just south of Idaho. You can't deny that things are changing. And then the length of the seasons. This season started, we're all kind of thinking, wow, this isn't, you know, going to be an extreme crazy fire season, at least at the beginning, and which was kind of nice because everyone was trying to figure out COVID. Then it got going and you're like, wow, this is pretty impressive. And you think of like the Thomas Fire in California, you know, we had a couple people down there at Christmas time. And then even here locally, you know, you think of just 2 weeks ago into November, even we're still having local fires, and everybody I know was sick of them. Talking to some friends over in Twin Falls, same thing. They're just like, we're tired of this fire season. So just, you know, last week when we got this snow, people were pretty happy. I thought October felt like more like August for a big part of this month locally. And, you know, usually it's like things start to taper down in October and, you know, still a lot of smoke in there to the point where you don't want to go out and ride your bicycle because, you know, it's like LA or Beijing or something for air quality.
I think a lot of us here in Pocatello, certainly, we live really at that boundary between wild spaces and urban spaces. And of course, we enjoy being so close. But what can we do as citizens to sort of help out and make your jobs a little easier and our own lives a little better without fires?
Yeah, good question. You can do lots of things. One is if you know, lucky enough to live in those nice places where you're up in the hills and a subdivision that's prone to fire. And one thing we forget is that everything around here developed with fire. And now we've kind of taken fire out of the picture for the most part. And at some point, you know, we learn lessons that this place isn't done burning. And you can look around Pocatello and I think a great example is the Charlotte Fire, and you have houses all in there. And at some point, you know, you just get the right conditions. And so if you live in those areas and around Pocatello, we have a lot of juniper, and you put enough wind on juniper and it'll burn. And you saw that on the Charlotte Fire. Having that defensible space around your house is huge. And, you know, taking some time to educate yourself as a homeowner and then do the proper amount of clearing the vegetation around your house. You know, even things like piles of firewood and things like that around your house are going to work against you if you have a fire coming through. Some other things are just, you know, responsibility when you're out in the wild lands. You know, fireworks are one area that's kind of an easy gimme, and be aware of, you know, what you're doing with fireworks, and then also, you know, equipment when you're out working and it's 90 degrees out and windy, you know, running a chainsaw or operating heavy equipment, just asking yourself, hey, what are the consequences? Am I prepared to jump on that myself? Because once something gets going in the extreme of summer, it's going to be tough to beat. Exploding targets is another big one out in the wildlands and BLM land specifically. They start a lot of fire, and that's so preventable in my mind. I don't know, being aware of something like even cheatgrass and, you know, trying to prevent cheatgrass spread and that sort of thing, which is easy to do with vehicles and that sort of thing. Yeah, those are some good questions. And a lot of that is basic, but a lot of people don't maybe give as much thought to it as they could.
Appreciate that advice. We'll segue over to our trivia question. You know, at the top of the show, we asked, what is a Pulaski and its connection to Idaho? It's very important. Can you tell us about it?
I can. So a Pulaski is a very standard firefighting tool. The design has not really changed in many, many years. And as I understand it, Ed Pulaski, who was famous in the 1910 fires up at Wallace, Idaho, was the inventor of that tool. For people that don't know, it's basically an axe on one end. And then the backside is what's called an adze, which is kind of a grubbing tool. So you can chop on one side and grub on the other. It's a pretty amazing tool. Actually, you go out on a fire line, people are still using them. They've been around a long, long time. Ed Pulaski, for those that don't know, is famous for up in Wallace, Idaho. These fires were incredible, and this is before modern communications, so people had no idea what was coming, and they'd go down to the bars and round up a fire crew of whatever it took to bribe people with a few bucks to go fight some fire, which was pretty easy in those days, and lots of colorful stories to go with it. But they were kind of in a tight spot, and he put everybody in a cave, and people were wanting to get out of there because it was miserable. People were passing out for the lack of oxygen, and he held them in the cave at gunpoint. Did things a little different back in those days, but very effective. And as I understand it, everybody survived, which is pretty incredible. And I had an opportunity to go look at that cave a couple of years ago, and it was pretty amazing that quite a few people survived in this very tiny little cave.
Yeah, it's a big part of wildfire history, and Idaho is part of that.
Yeah,
for Idaho, we really do have a true hero, and I do recommend people to do a little bit of research on Ed Pulaski. He really is a unique and great character that has come out of this state. Really want to thank Randy Anderson for joining us today. And to learn more about fire in Idaho, please visit idahofireinfo.com or like their Facebook page, BLM Idaho Fire.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.